Right, here we go then. Start the show.
Picture this. Recording studios somewhere far, far away.
The Merry White House Experience! Thank you very much! Thank you. Well, 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 the Duchess of York is pregnant again. I don't know, she told me she was on the pill. But anyway, bets are already being laid on the name of the new royal baby. In fact, I was in a betting shop the other day trying to get 3-1 on the Arkansas Chug-a-Bug when... when this bloke came in and got 50 million to 1 on the new royal baby being called Darren, Adolf, Len, Ugo, Tracy, Oliver Cromwell, Schmendrick, Lottie, Tolmash, Tolmash, Dobbin, Windsor. Still, he was a stupid-looking bloke, left in a helicopter. I'm Dave Bedell, and this is Punt and Dennis.
Apart from Fergie going to have a baby, what's been the main story of this week?
Already, many hundreds have crossed over the line, and we're seeing no end to this unprecedented flow. We don't know when it'll stop, or how many thousands more there are to come.
A match report there from Liverpool v Crystal. Meanwhile, people were going from East Germany to West Germany. But they were travelling via Czechoslovakia into Hungary, through Austria and into Bavaria. Why this strange route? The answer is, as we now know, that this is the first instance of political refugees going interrailing. These people have got to be students.
Yeah, we are escaping from an oppressive regime, starting in Paris, then we go south, cross into Italy, go to Venice, into Yugoslavia.
It's incredibly cheap once you get there.
Then into Romania, Hungary and Austria.
Some of the emigrants have made the trip to West Germany via Denmark and Scandinavia. Others have hitched round Australia, stopped over in Fiji, and then taken the Trans-Siberian Express. But why?
Germany is a constant reminder of East-West tension.
Notably in Berlin, where in 1961, an audacious plan was announced.
Oh, my good God. You want a partition put in here, do you?
Yeah.
Well, that's a big job. I mean, when do you want it done by?
Tomorrow morning.
Do what, Obergruppenführer?
The wall must be built overnight.
Overnight? You're joking, sunshine. You want 500,000 sheets of plasterboard. You haven't even chosen the colour scheme for the barbed wire, and the machine gun emplacements don't come cheap, especially if you want the flushings geometrically properly, you know what I mean? Well, I'm sorry, mate, but we're looking at next April, if you're lucky. Oh, you bleeding shot me. I warn you, I'll have to charge you VAT on the bullet.
The Berlin Wall still stands as a symbol of the East-West divide, and there is no sign of it being pulled down, although there are signs in the era of Gorbachev that it might be rag-rolled given some Laura Ashley light fittings and have some nice pictures hung on it.
And so, a nation is divided. Even though German politics has moved in 45 years from the bunker onto the Greens, there are still huge gulfs between the two sides. British schoolchildren always learn German in the form of West German. East German is the same language, but the sentences in the textbooks are slightly different.
Can you tell me the way to the nearest butcher's?
There isn't one.
What is the time, please?
Times that the workers stood side by side in the glorious march of freedom from capitalist oppression.
Thank you.
In West Germany, a major green issue is something like...
Do sulfur emissions cause acid rain?
In East Germany, a major green issue is...
Shall we boil this cabbage or eat it raw?
And so the East German refugees are pouring over the border in their bid to come to the West. Once in West Germany, they soon become full West German citizens. They sew little flags on the sleeves of their parkas, they grow bum fluff moustaches and like Barclay James Harvest.
Of course, political refugees are usually only welcome in the West if they can prove their economic worth to the country of destination, viz. The British attitude to Hong Kong. The East Germans should have no problem here, their 20-year-old cars, nylon-flared trousers and sideburns ensuring immediate employment presenting programmes for the Open University.
Well,
Well, as anyone who watches BBC Two will know, or to be precise, Mrs. Edith Arnstead of the Alzheimer Care Foundation in Buxton, the conference season is on us again. Firstly, we had the TUC conference, a spectacle that lovingly recreates the whole feel of double mass on a Friday. Every speech is the same.
Brothers, I won't say sisters, because it might make you think that my next line is, we don't need this fascist groove fang. Let me say, first of all, then it can have escaped. No one's noticed that my trousers are brown. And my glasses are the cheapest form of private glasses you can buy. But still, for some reason, not national health. Now I take them off for dramatic effect. And I glance down at my notes. And I realise I can't read them. So, I say again, brothers, my trousers are brown. And all the rest of the things I said at the start of the speech until I found my place again. Ah. Now, fists on the lectern over and over and over again. And hoping to get a round of applause simply by doing a lot of shouting. And now pretending I'm not interested in the applause by talking over it. But in fact, I'm over the moon, as this means at last I'm going to be the excerpt they use on News at 10. And therefore, possibly, if not probably, get off with Brenda Dean later on.
Meanwhile, in Bournemouth this week, we've seen the conference of the SDLP, or the SLDP, or the WANKERS. Now, the ridiculous thing about this conference is that they will insist on talking about important topics as if they had some influence on them. Politicians are always talking about something called the real agenda. We think the real agenda for a day at the SDLP conference should be this.
9 a.m. NATO. Do we remain committed? The environment. Plans for the 90s. 10 a.m. Realise no one gives a toss what we think. And go for a walk on the pier, smiling and shaking our heads about how we could have been so stupid. 11 a.m. Get pissed and rather maudlin. Try to get off with Rosie Barnes.
And then, of course, there is the Tory party conference. The amazing thing about the Tory party conference is that it does not involve voting. The party that forced unions to introduce ballots, that goes on and on about the need to introduce one man, one vote into the Labour Party, never ever vote on their own internal policies. This makes it not a conference, but a rally. And of course, historically, a rally doesn't leave much room for debate.
Die das hilflose Bild jagt und hetzt.
Well, now to move the motion against Chancellor Hitler, Rabbi Jacobs. No, come on, you've had your say, Adolf. We can't overrun, we've got the debate on whether or not to invade Poland at 3 o'clock.
So now the Conservative Conference is just a TV spectacle. Every speech is more and more packaged for TV.
And the country is once more respected throughout the world, and everything is absolutely marvellous. Our industries are strong and... Hang on a minute, who's this? Oh, it's Gordon the Gopher. Not now, Gordon. What is it? Oh, yes. With the time coming up to 5:25, it's time to press the switch that says goodbye to all our viewers in Northern Ireland.
Picture this.
And now the Tracy Brothers Experience presents a song about private enterprise.
1, 2, 3, 4!
My bank account was in the red. A friend of mine came up and said, there ain't no need to be downhearted, boy. I know a place that'll pay you well. You've only got one thing to sell. Make money doing something you enjoy. Woo. I went down, I signed a form. They showed me to a room where I suppose the interviews had been. They handed me a test tube and slapped me on the back and offered me a dirty magazine. So get on down to the sperm bank, 'cause it's time to give your overdraft the sugar. I said, sperm bank, hey, come on, sperm bank. Just get on down, get on that rubber glove. No, you can't meet sex with someone that you love. No way. Now if there's some place I wanna be, but the train fare is too steep for me, well normally I would be in a mess. But I don't need to use my thumb, if I wanna go, I go and come, cause this bank is the one that likes to say yes. Woo! If I can't afford to see my girl, I'll hop down to the bank, cause it's the one I never leave forlorn. But cause I make deposits over 40 times a week, when we go to bed, I'm always overdrawn. Thanks to the goddamn sperm bank, sperm bank. Ah, but it's the only place I'm dreaming of. I said, sperm bank, come on, sperm bank, where all your prayers are answered from above. Cause you can't beat sex with someone that you love. Hey, you know it's the truth. So the next time you're down on your luck, come on, get on down and make a buck. You've heard this song, so now you must agree. And the next time you're excited, stop. Just think of all that wasted glop. There ain't no point in doing it for free. Well, get on down to the sperm bank. I said sperm bank, because it's time to give that overdraft a shove. I said sperm bank, come on, sperm bank. You just slip on down, slip on that rubber glove. Well, you can't beat sex with someone that you love. No, you can't beat sex with someone that you love. Well, you can't beat sex with someone that you love. Okay.
Now this week, the Labour Party officially complained to the IBA about the amount that the government spends on advertising. Now although the commercials have become slicker and more professional recently, there has long been government propaganda broadcast on TV. As anyone who leaves the TV on after the late night film has finished will know, government information films have been around for a long time, concerning such subjects as smoking in bed, swimming when the red flag is flying, and the dangers of overtaking on motorways.
These films all have one thing in common. They're all made in the 60s and they've never been remade. Everybody in them wears Engelbert Humperdinck sideburns and tank tops. The policemen ride bicycles and everyone drives the Austin 1100. Which explains why it was so dangerous overtaking on motorways. These films have now lost their impact through age. When the bloke falls asleep in bed and his fag sets his bed on fire and burns his house down, the viewer tends to think that anyone with a haircut like that deserves it, frankly.
What is equally puzzling is why, after seeing a piece about how leaving electrical plugs in at night can be a fire hazard, is there any need to say, that was a government information film? Just in case anyone was under the impression that it won the Palme d'Or at the Cannes Festival.
One famous film of this ilk was The Curb Drill. Look right, look left, look right again. And if nothing's coming, you obviously don't live in London. In the early 70s, this was deemed to be too simple, and it was replaced by the Green Cross Code.
Now here we see an interesting conflict between different government campaigns. One minute you'd be watching a film telling children not to talk to strangers. The next minute, two children would be quite happily chatting to a large, muscular man in green tights. A green shirt and an old green curtain meant to look like a cake, offering to help them home from school. Now, governments have advertised to get their message across for longer than that, however. In medieval England, the increase in traffic speed and the consequent danger resulted in the memorable campaign,
think once, think twice, think sedan chair.
In some spheres, the government even experimented with interactive advertising.
Have you ever thought of joining the Navy? It's a fine life on the ocean wave, a fleet of men of war in a fair wind headed for the Indies. The cannon primed and ready.
Yes, well, actually, I'm quite happy as a tinker's apprentice.
Tough shit! You're coming with us!
In the 18th century, this technique of forcing innocent passers-by into degradation and danger was known as press ganging. Nowadays, it is known as beadles about. However, for those who lost limbs in the subsequent battles, the government encouraged the use of wooden legs through the slogan, clunk click every trip.
In the French Revolution, the new government sold their policy of guillotining the monarchy with the line,
training the heads of the people to be people without heads.
That particular slogan reappeared in the first term of Mrs. Thatcher's government as,
training the workers without jobs to be the workers without jobs.
Hello everyone, my name's Mark and this is the bit of the show where I discuss the topic of the week and then I come amongst you, obviously not literally, but I just sort of, and I come along and get your views and opinions on the topic. What I decided, I mean there's loads of stuff been happening, you know, in Berlin and then Fergie getting pregnant, which I just don't give a monkeys about. It'd be really great if Princess Anne was. Or if Fergie's baby looked like Mark Phillips, that would be great. But, What I wanted to talk about this week was superstition and religion. People use religion to their own means and they twist the meaning of it. Like Christianity would be quite nice, but you get these little right wingers who get hold of it and they go, oh yes, you see, AIDS. AIDS is God's vengeance on the gay people, the naughty shirt lifting chappies. That's rubbish. AIDS is not God's vengeance on the gay community because the lowest risk group for AIDS are lesbians. If that's God's vengeance, then God's a dyke. I just don't believe in any form of religion at all. Not until I've watched Night of the Living Dead at 3 o'clock in the morning. I'm a completely changed person. Like, I watched that movie and I think, right, I better go to bed. Oh, well, as I'm going to bed, I better switch all the lights in the house on then, hadn't I? I'm standing there thinking, Mark, come on, you're a rational human being. There's no God, there's no devil, there's no ghost, there's no supernatural, this is all superstition. Why are you painting a crucifix on the bedroom door? What's going on? And this little voice in my ear will just suddenly go, Mark, there's a vampire in the house. Oh, come on, that's just, is there? Is there? And within 30 seconds, I've covered the duvet with garlic paste. I've whittled a steak out of a rolling pin. I'm on the phone to the operator going, look, I don't know the address, but there's got to be a Dr. Van Helsing in the London area. And if you can't get me that, get me a 24-hour holy water delivery service. I'm completely turned inside out by all this. And I have to sort of stop myself and just go, come on, if you're that worried, say a little prayer. Well, hello. I know I don't believe in you. But if you do exist, which you probably don't because empirically you can't do, but if you do and there is such a thing as vampires and if they just happen to be in the Tooting area, could you see your way to directing them next door and I'll see you on Sunday? It's just awful because I suppose I try really hard to bring myself back to reality when I get wound up and think, come on, back to reality, calm down. This is just superstitious, supercilious, mumbo-jumbo. It's a hangover from the past. And your horoscope said it was going to be great today. So just come on, get a grip. How many people here actually read their horoscopes? Just a rough shout. Just shout out if you do, after three. One, two, three. Quite a few people read them. I'm a natural skeptic, so the horoscope's the only bit in the newspaper I believe in. But it is weird, all the superstitions we have, like a lucky rabbit's foot. Now, rabbits are known for their ability to procreate. So what bit do we chop off and say it's lucky? The foot! But I think the worst bit of superstition is that treading in dog shit is lucky. Especially if you're wearing sandals. If treading in dog shit is so lucky, why do the people in the old Kent Road still live there? The place is covered in dog shit. It's incredible. I think that one was made up. I think the person who thought that was just taking the piss. They're at Glastonbury or someone and someone fell in the cesspit and went, oh, Kev, you fell in the cesspit, you lucky bastard. That's where that one came from. So but they adapt and change all the time. And I was thinking maybe in 100 years' time, we're going to have sort of like new superstitions. Like if you drive past a nuclear power station in a car, you'll go, oh, look, there's a nuclear power station. Quick, spit over your shoulder, clap 3 times, shout, I didn't buy the shares, otherwise you get leukemia. Anyway, we're going to come around. Oh, well, I'm going to come around more specifically and ask, what are your superstitions? We'll ask the tracksuit man, because are you superstitious at all?
Loads.
Loads. I think the tracksuit man's been on steroids. Loads. No, what are you superstitious about?
Taking drugs.
Taking drugs? What, if you don't get enough of them, it's unlucky.
It's the Harry Whitehouse Experience. And now the character assassination experience, where we take a prominent personality and critically evaluate them in all their complexity. This week, Terry Wogan.
Terry Wogan was born on the 3rd of June, 1854. He emerged from his mother's womb wearing a wig. His first words were,
It's not a wig.
Soon he grew a full head of hair, but carried on wearing a wig. Then, lo and behold, he became a television personality on Blankety Blank, but he was to leave the programme following this incident.
And now the next question. Sir Terence of Wogan once lost all his hair and had to wear a blank.
But tragically, Terry's pretense of hair ownership has always been flawed by the fact that his name sounds a little bit like wig on. In fact, this is his real name, and his middle name is I've Got A. Terry, I've Got A Wig On. At the age of 25, it occurred to him that this was a bit of a giveaway. But this was, in fact, to help Terry's early career. He was soon invited to host a similar show to Vision On, the programme for the deaf, called Wig On, for blind people.
Now, you may have heard of the Tom Hanks film Big. Terry was once in a similar film called Wig. Now, the plot of Big is that Tom Hanks, an adult man, magically becomes a child. In Wig, Wogan plays a bald man who magically grows a full head of hair after one visit to the wig shop.
But keeping up the facade has, of course, not been easy, and there have been times when Terry has felt a desperate desire to confess. For example, it was only after much persuasion that Terry's friends convinced him to change the title of his one chart song, The Floral Dance, from its original title, All Right, I'm Bald. Now, Terry is our top interviewer, and the reason he's always touching women on the bare knee is that he thinks he's scratching his head. But what can one perceive about Terry from the way that other presenters have handled his show? Ben Elton brought his own original and fresh touch to the programme by starting off every show not wearing a wig.
Yes, indeed, and I'm very pleased to have on the show a lot of the people who, for some reason, Terry has never wanted to have on the show himself. Terry Savalas, Gordon Honeycomb, and Barbara Carlin. But here, to start off the show, yes, indeed, ladies and gentlemen, I don't care, save it for later. Anyway, to start off the show with some funky sounds, please welcome Hot Chocolate.
Terry is thought to be a member of a secret society of top celebrities who all wear wigs. Other members of this society include Bruce Forsyth, Richard Whiteley, and Duncan Goodhue. This society meets at a secret address in London where the wigs are collected at the door and the celebrities feel free to circulate unencumbered and scalp naked. This place is known as the Wigless Club. I'm sorry. But what about Terry's other interests? Well, for example, in Who's Who, Terry lists among his casual interests going to the barbers twice, maybe four times a week, buying shampoo, cartwheeling, going swimming without worrying about it, using a blow dryer without checking that the windows are closed first, and taking his hat off without then looking in the inside of the hat.
Now, some of you may accuse us in this character analysis of not having done an in-depth study, but rather of being obsessionally fixated on one thing. In reply to this, we would say that we have looked at as many aspects of Terry Wogan's personality as there are hairs on his head. My name's Richard Edis. Good night. Thank you.
Welcome to Murder Weekend. Tonight, for some reason never quite properly explained, five personalities, casual acquaintances, have met up to spend the weekend together in a castle in the countryside. Unbeknown to them, over the course of the next 48 hours, one of them will become the victim of a callous murderer. You, the audience, are required to solve the murder. The clues are in the narratives. The guests include Claire Rayner.
Hello, lovey. Fat, ugly, no friends. That's my entry for Who's Who, finished.
Her Royal Highness, Her Majesty the Queen.
And now some swearing. Poo.
Jimmy Savile.
Now then. Hit me on the back, some blood there.
Doris McWhirter.
Now, I only entered this castle because I thought its first name was Roy.
And Ronnie Corbett. Good Lord, someone shot Ronnie Corbett. But with his dying breath, he may yet be able to communicate who the murderer is.
The murderer is... And by the way, when I talk about murder... I don't mean the last 25 years with my wife. But I digress. Seeing as I've got blood pumping out of my aorta, which, by the way, isn't a type of suet pudding. Aorta, we're getting warmer. It isn't that. The identity of the murderer is...
Well, I'm afraid he's dead.
Oh, damn bugger blast!
I didn't know you were such a fan of Ronnie Corbett's, Mum.
No, one isn't. One is just still swearing. I'll name that tune in three.
Now the first murder has been committed. This is where the studio audience comes in. In this whodunit, you, the audience, are the detective. Firstly, motive. Why would anyone want to kill Ronnie Corbett? Okay, so the motive's there. We have to compile some clues. Firstly, whose country castle are we actually at? Have we got any suggestions there? You, sir?
Dracula's.
Dracula's, that's a good one. He owns a country castle. Okay, so we're at Dracula's home. Secondly, what had this disparate group of individuals actually come together for? Does anyone have any ideas? You, madam.
No, I haven't any ideas.
Good, okay, sounds like a hamster, but okay. Have you got any ideas?
The SDP conference.
The SDP conference, okay, which is in a castle in Bournemouth, apparently. Okay, and lastly, the most important question in any murder inquiry, who is the butler? The butler.
Fatima Whitbread.
Fatima Whitbread. Yeah, could be. No, it isn't actually Fatima Whitbread because, and perhaps we should have told you this before, the butler is Charles Manson. But Charlie's learned that there are always ways of proving your innocence.
Hello! Oh, what a lovely day. What a lovely day, Mrs. A lovely day for taking out your tickling stick and killing everyone in the Polanski household.
Sort me, what was that?
It's Charlie Manson. He's been poisoned. I told him not to drink the tap water. So, that rules out Charlie Manson. Now, are we any closer to the murderer? The clues have been there in the narrative. Well, actually, they haven't, but they weren't in the one with Michael Aspel, either.
Well, actually, David, post-mortem evidence has shown that Charles Manson wasn't actually poisoned.
Okay, thank you, Norris. So, how was he killed? Any ideas? Man in a tracksuit. Perhaps he looked at you for a while, I don't know.
Stabbed.
Okay, Charles Manson was killed by being stabbed. Now, back at the weekend, some of the guests are beginning to suspect that the house may be haunted. So they employ the services of the most fearless Ghostbusters in the world.
Like, well, Scooby. like, your name sounds like a bowel infection, Scooby. Quick, Scoob, do some impressions.
Tommy Cooper. Right. A spoon.
So, we're no nearer discovering who the murderer is. And time appears to be running out. Who has just been killed? It's up to you. Remember, it could be the Queen, it could be Norris McWhirter, it could be Jimmy Savile, or any of the other characters who have turned up so far. So, who is it? I'm going to ask this gentleman here, who has been killed just now?
Claire Rayner.
Claire Rayner. Yes, that's a popular decision, I imagine. So, next week we take it up from the murder of Claire Rayner. The audience have been a pretty crap detective, so by then, we will have drafted in the services of a real professional.
Now, were you in the area of Dracula's castle last Friday? Did you see the Queen, Jimmy Savile, Ronnie Corbett, Claire Rayner and Norris McWhirter going there for the purposes of the SLD conference? If you did, perhaps you can tell us where you got the LSD, as I've lost the uncanny the way that fitted in, as I've lost the address of my dealer. I'll name that tune in two. Thank you.
You've been listening to the Merry White House Experience. It was written and performed by David Baddiel, Rob Newman, Steve Punt, Hugh Days, Mark Thomas, the Tracy Brothers and Susie Brand. The production assistant was Barbara Keir, the sound was by Alec Hale-Munro, and the producer was Bill Dare.